Today, down the rabbit hole again, where does power actually lie? Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. One of this post covering finance and property news. Well, I'm back for another down the rabbit hole with my friend George. Hi, George. Nice to see you again.
Hello, Martin. A lot has changed in the last 6 to 8 months or so around the world in Western countries. Things are hotting up.
Yeah, you see, it's really interesting, George, because I've been watching events very closely, and it's interesting when you read all of the media reports about, you know, Donald Trump has done this and, you know, the world is changing. Now, I'm going to talk to you today about a thesis that I'm developing, which suggests that actually very little is really changing in terms of where power lays. But actually what is changing is the transparency. In other words, what was hidden until relatively recently is now out in the open. And in fact, the truth is that we have a very small number of very large players with immense power that have for generations dictated what is going on around the place. And that is continuing. So it's not so much that fundamentally things have changed, but now it's a bit more transparent. And actually, it's more horrendous because it's more transparent.
Well, I think you're right, because sooner or later, these power players are going to have to show themselves eventually, because they're the ones in charge. And I'm thinking along the lines of the WEF, the UN, the WHO, the WTO, all big players in terms of what happens around the world and where economies run and where the where funds are actually concentrated. So there seems to be they're moving the currency from the West to the East, the power of currency. That's what I see. What do you say?
Well, yeah, so I think it's a very interesting question, particularly about, of course, the US dollar that has been effectively the stopgap global currency of stability, the currency of trade, the currency that effectively has determined what happens in many different jurisdictions. Now, that is a little bit under question at the moment with the BRICS and China and gold. In fact, if you look, we've got a bit of a rejiggling between US treasuries and gold in terms of the backstops at central banks and those sorts of things. So that's all there. But I want to bring you back to the concept that the big guys in the room are the guys with the power and the money and the weight. And when I say power, I don't just mean political power, but I mean military power. And I want to take you to a quote. Now, there's a guy called Lord Palmerston, who was a prime minister in the UK in the 1800s. And he had a really interesting quote. And I want to quote it to you exactly. He said, "We have no eternal allies. We have no perpetual enemies. Our interests are eternal and perpetual, and those interests, it is our duty to follow." Now, what he was getting at was that, you know, you might have relationships with and alliances with particular countries and with particular players at different times, but there's a set of interests that are eternal and perpetual, and that's essentially about maintaining their power and authority. Remember, this was said at the time when the true story was that the British Empire was pretty much at its peak. Maybe it was just beginning to fade at that point, but, you know, pretty much its peak. But they were able to extend power around the world, play a game that said, yeah, we'll give you a little bit of freedom here, a little bit of freedom there, but actually they were setting all of the rules. Now, I would argue that that is precisely what has been going on for the last couple of hundred years. There was a change in the baton, and that baton got passed to the US. And of course, you know, through the 20th and now the 21st century, the US is the entity with almost infinite power in terms of its military might and its financial firepower. The dollar as we said earlier on, you know, is a little bit under pressure, but the dollar is still very much lodged at the center of the global economy now. Trump and the Monroe Doctrine, you know, that is basically saying, no, we're going to make sure that we maintain our stranglehold on the whole of the Americans. You know, you can come here if you like, but under our rules and regulations, hence the discussion about Venezuela and about Greenland. I think what's happened is that that power never went away. That idea of the interests of the Americas and the Americans is what's driving almost everything. Now, we've got China, of course, on the rise now, and they're the number two economy, and they are not necessarily wanting to play this same game. And you mentioned players like the UN and the World Economic Forum. No, they are very much under the umbrella of that US idea of power and might. But it was wrapped up in the idea of globalism, the idea of international trade, and all the other things that we've been spoken to since particularly the Second World War as being in the interests of the global community. But actually, it was interests of a relatively small proportion of the global community. And so my argument is that we are in the middle at the moment where the veil is being removed and where this raw power that the US has and had is actually now being more overtly manifest. But it doesn't mean that the world has changed. It just means that now the veil has been removed.
So we're starting to see the consequences of that veil. Now, remember I mentioned in some previous episode about Rockefeller Rothschild's secret covenant. And what you're saying tends to tie in with this. And I want to read just a small section. I'll make it small. We will create separate fronts to prevent them from seeing the connection between us. Now, I believe, and I think you're onto it, that we're not just seeing a power play going on here. We're seeing governments controlled like a chess game. And while they appear to be in opposition to each other, they're actually leading us to the same point, indirectly. And you would probably know that we've got this thing called BRICS, and you've got the US dollar. And these two groups have kind of come into some sort of clash with each other. And the US dominates the world through controlling oil. Interesting, that Venezuela. So I think that this isn't going to last too much longer, but I can see the currency, the US dollar, actually in its last days. I think we're going to see it fall into decay, and it's kind of like spurting its last power, which is its military might, and eventually it's all going to fall to pieces. That's what I see.
Well, you see, again, there are many people who are talking about the end of the dollar dominance and the end of the US power. But I'm arguing back that you're not actually taking into account the might of the US in terms of its military capability, as it's displayed in recent times. And the fact that despite what everybody has been saying, the US dollar is still very much at the center of the global financial system. And of course, this Powell Trump conversation about who actually sets the interest rates, right? It's really interesting, mm-hmm. Where Powell is effectively being subpoenaed vis-a-vis the building and construction operations at the central bank. I chuckled when I heard it because I was thinking, well, there's a big building development going on just down the road of the White House, Trump, which probably is worth a little look too. But the point is that I wonder whether the script that says the US is over, the US dollar is over, is being written too quickly and too soon. Now, I know that there is the China connection, and I understand the BRICS connection, and I understand this idea of the different spheres of influence. And of course, there are people who are saying, well, actually, maybe they've almost mutually agreed that China will actually have the Asian area, the US will have the US America area, and that leaves Russia and a bit of Europe, where they can fight it out amongst themselves. Now, that is one way of looking at it. But I'm also going to argue that if you look at what's been going on with what Trump has been doing, so for example, Venezuela had very strong connections with Russia, and with China. And in fact, some of the oil that was being shipped out was actually being shipped out on those grey ships. Now that oil is going via the US, which means that effectively maybe that supply won't be available, at least the cheap rates, to the likes of China. So that's an example where the US is asserting its authority. And if you think about the Greenland conversation, is fascinating because it was Greenland through Denmark is part of the, you know, the greater NATO Euro footprint. But Trump is saying, no, we want to actually, rule the roost there and control it because of the security risks to the US. But those security risks relate to activity, particularly Russia, as the poles, the North Pole in particular, melts more frequently, gives more trade routes and more critical minerals. I'm about to make the critical minerals point. Of course, there's been a big debate between China and the US about critical minerals, but it's interesting that Venezuela and Greenland have huge critical mineral resources potentially available. So to my mind, don't write the US off too quick when you actually think about where the power actually sits at the moment. And that is an important observation. I wanted to make another point too, though. Think about those big global corporations, a lot of the tech bros and a lot of the oil companies and a lot of the other large banks, for example. They are all lodged firmly into that US story. Now, I would regard them as very much coupled to this same wagon. And if you want to understand the global dynamics, just look at the size of the US stock market and the US investment pools relative to other countries. It's massive. And that ain't going away anytime soon. So I would argue that the US still has many of the cards they're holding at the moment. And they're playing those cards in a way to the benefit of make America great, make the American business great.
Yes, that's more like
but
it.
the implications for the rest of the world are pretty profound. And look, something like Australia, right, which is a little country caught between the US and China, caught between significant trade relationships with China. China recently announced, of course, a very significant hike in their actual overall exports, which is quite interesting. Australia is caught paying massive amounts to the AUKUS project in the US, despite the fact we may or may not get any submarines, who knows. The US is using more of Australia as a forward base in terms of asserting power over into the Asian region too. So I'm arguing that anybody who writes the US story off too quick is actually maybe not understanding history very well.
Well, I agree with you because I think we've got the US dollar will hang in there as long as Trump has actually got control of a very large military. And the other one, of course, is he's got control of oil sales, although there is a bit of a disconnect going on there with BRICS. But he can also make it very difficult for BRICS with his military. And so I think that the US dollar is not gone, of course not, but I think it's in decay. And I think the American empire is in decay, but it's still got a lot of strength. And while Trump is there doing these decisions that he's doing, which I didn't expect Trump to suddenly want to take over Greenland, but he has spoken of it before. And the powers at the top are doing what I think is a melt-up of the entire world economy. And so if you look around the world, countries all over the world, you've got assets going up and up and up, like real estate, like resources are going up. We're having a bit of a boom in the stock market, similar to what happened prior to the 1929 Great Depression. Well, eventually, what is the market at the end of the day? What is it? I would have thought the market is the greater community. And we've got to feed that market because it's got to get its profits somewhere. And of course, it's getting harder and harder and harder for the consumer to consume.
Well, yeah. So the asset inflation, which we are seeing most asset types, whether it's property, whether it's gold or silver, other minerals too, they're all going up. Of course, the stock markets are up too. That's directly correlated with the significant increase in global debt. And if you look at the global debt footprint, guess who's pumping debt? It's the US. And the recent announcement of stable coins, the recent issue with regards to lower interest rates in the US, you know, all of that, and the treasury issuance in the US is continuing to increase the amount of debt from the US. China is, of course, also pumping debt higher. And even smaller countries like the UK or Australia are continuing to grow their public debt. Now, of course, there have been excuses. The COVID excuse, for example, perhaps the global financial crisis previous to that, you know, we had to save the economy, et cetera, et cetera. But we are in a one-way street here with this amount of debt that's in the system. There's more debt in the system than ever before. It's continuing to grow. That is why asset prices are going up, because dollars or other currencies are chasing those assets. Another way of thinking about it is the value of your dollar is actually going down, because the more that's printed, the effectively the less that single dollar that you have is worth. And the truth is that the real spending power of the dollar is going down. But that is an important perspective here, because it's irreversible. There is no way that we're going to see the global debt bubble get diffused. It's going to continue to rise. And the question is, how much will it rise? And is there an end point? I don't think there is. I think it can continue to rise a lot more from here. And that means that we still expect to see the asset bubble continuing to blow. But you make the connection back to the Great Depression. And there are some very interesting and important correlations between what's happening now with the greater authoritarian push. In other words, I'm using naked power to assert my influence and effect. The fact that the stock markets are bubbling a lot higher, the fact that more people are crowding in and talking about all of these, you know, whether it's Bitcoin or whatever it is, more people are actually exposing themselves to the markets. I want to make the point that if you look at the previous crises when they crash, who were the losers? The major losers?
The public. Ordinary people. The ordinary people, of course.
Correct. Who is the loser when property prices continue to bubble high? It's actually ordinary people, because the housing affordability crisis just gets worse and worse. Plus the fact that, of course, as the debt rises and government borrowing rises, particularly with interest rates where they are now, the cost of debt continues to rise. And that means they have to take a greater share of the tax take to be able to pay for the interest on the debt. Now, the US is doing some quite interesting things in terms of issuing short-term debt rather than long-term debt and cancelling some of the longer-term debt, because the interest rate differential means it's more attractive to issue short-term rather than long-term at the moment. But there are some risks attached to that, of course, when it comes to refinancing ahead. And more broadly, everyone's doing it. So the fact of the matter is that if you think that the first force of power is actually this idea of, you know, of military might and will, the second force of power then is the global debt burden. Mm-hmm. Who are the winners in the debt burden? Those big financial institutions, mm-hmm. who are actually making billions and billions and billions, both through trading and also through the various financial engineering projects that they get involved in. So they are actually loving it. And so one of the reasons why we've got a very profitable stock market is because it's the mutual reinforcing of the debt growing, the debt issuance, all of that stuff. And I make the final point here. It's not just public debt, but private debt. So if you look at the growth in private debt over the last two or three decades, it's massive. Mm. So the amount of debt that ordinary Australians have and other ordinary people around the world, it's gone through the roof. Why? Because mortgages are so much more than they were, because prices are higher than they were. So we've got this massive private sector debt burden. That private sector debt burden allows corporations in the financial system to effectively just send a message, create more money. And in fact, the inflationary pressures from the private sector issuance of debt are more significant, in my mind, even than the public sector debt issuance, which is massive too. So we've got these big inflationary forces. Now, these inflationary forces are important to understand because one of the things that we're going to see is inflation not going away. And so, again, ordinary people are being trapped with bigger debt, trapped with real incomes not keeping up with what's going on, at the same time that the tax take is actually ever bigger because it needs to be bigger to be able to pay for all that public sector debt. So we've got this massive amount of a pressure on ordinary people. And again, I want to come back to the fact that if you were a small open economy like Australia, we are exposed to these forces. We can't control them. We're like a little cork on the water. But we are the recipient of higher inflation. We are the recipient of higher debt. And we are a recipient of higher asset prices because of those policies. And it's worth just reflecting on this, George. You know, this idea of global trade being good and, you know, we should trade as much as we can. Well, actually, we've had a hollowing out of our manufacturing in Australia because of it. We've actually are building less ourselves. We're taking, becoming more reliant on the global manufacturer, China. You know, China actually controls a lot of the supply chains around the world. So we are becoming ever more dependent. And that's my sort of bottom line here. The way that power works, the way that the system works, it means that smaller economies are becoming more and more dependent, less able to actually even look after their own communities and their own people. And ordinary people are ending up trapped in a future where, as we've said before, you know, running faster to stand still. Well, now we know the reason why. The power plays behind the scenes are now actually out in the open, and that's why we've got the problems we've got.
Yeah, well, isn't it interesting now? Dare I go down the conspiracy theory track, but this, let's just call this misinformation and disinformation to keep the algorithm happy, okay? But isn't it interesting that after the GFC, we went through a bounce, and you mentioned the K-shaped recovery. Now, interesting about the K-shaped recovery, certain sectors of the economy did really well. The ones that are doing really well now still. And other sections, like the small business trader, didn't do so well. Because what's happening to the small business trader, they're loaded with more and more expenses. Their rent, three tiers of government taxing them. Okay, when you put it all together and you look at all the ongoing costs coming to them from suppliers, etc., they really don't have a lot of control over anything. But the corporations, like the government, you've got a problem with costs? That's okay, I'll just write out $1 trillion and hand it out to the economy. And when they took that $1 trillion, just exactly where did it go? That's a lot of money. I'd like to know where it went. Well, a lot of it went on to our COVID problem, and that was convenient, so they had an excuse there, and they keep coming up with excuses. Now, the media are doing a fantastic job, except for you, Martin, you seem to ask a few questions, but the general mainstream media seem to kind of say things that don't make sense. And I think on one occasion, one of the financial reporters on the ABC actually said that the economy had come back in, it bounced back up, but certain sectors of the economy weren't doing well. And he said, "I just don't get it." That was Alan Kohler. And I'm thinking, geez, Alan, you should have a talk to Martin. I think he'd be able to fix you up on that. He'd explain it really well. You might not want to have him on your show, though. So, look, I agree. I don't think the US dollar's dead yet. But if they continue to go down this path and you continue to increase debt levels all around the world, it's going to destroy the currencies of the world. That's what I see. So I think there's a big buying up of precious metal by central banks of all people. Interesting that. And I suppose at the end of the day, when the currency becomes worthless, then what have you got left? You've only got assets. And you've got bullion, and bullion's never been considered to be, it's been considered by some people as a rock that just sits still, doesn't do anything. Well, I tell you what, in the last 6 months, it's been doing things. All of a sudden, I wonder why people are starting to get very nervous and they're starting to visit their bullion dealers. But I think that they're smelling a rat, so to speak, and they can see what's going on. They don't seem to have much other, any other sort of protection.
Well, it's clear to me that the silver and gold story, and other precious metals too, is part of this idea of, well, we can't necessarily trust the government, we can't necessarily trust the financial markets. So, you know, they are actually assets that actually provide a backstop. Traditionally, they've been used in a portfolio as, you know, a bit of a bedrock, you know, a bit of safe and secure. We've seen massive hikes in the value, unsustainable hikes, I would suggest, but that doesn't mean they're going to stop going up at the moment because of the other reasons that we've been talking about. And there's been greater interest, of course, in trying to find asset protection. It's very fascinating, too, if you look carefully at the position of some of those large, big international financial conglomerates and the way that they're playing this at the moment. They're making a lot of money on the trades on the way through. And I think it's important to understand that volatility is what those players actually love, because they make money in volatility. End holders, not necessarily so much. So I expect we will continue to see the stable discussion about gold and silver as a, you know, a force of stabilization playing out. I expect we'll see the value of those going up. But of course, you can't eat gold. No. So you've still got to find a way of converting it back to something which is more fungible if you need to ultimately use it for, you know, to get by. And I suppose, you know, thinking about the large corporates, I've spoken a bit about the financial system and the financial players. Another one I think we should talk about briefly is this yin and yang between the health industries and the big food industries. And you'll know that there's been a massive growth in the fat jabs recently. And now there's a discussion about, well, we can actually, you know, put people on these jabs and they'll be on jabs for life, right? And, you know, the food industry is, well, you know, been pushing poor quality food for a long, long time, at the same time as the health industry is saying, oh, well, that's okay. We'll have people completely dependent on these drugs for life. So those are two industries that are benefiting again from this massive focus of power. And almost wherever you look, you know, you can almost look at it by sector, by sector, by sector. You see this same idea, the large corporates actually setting their own agenda, driving, of course, massive returns to shareholders. And that's why if you look at growth of income, the income to shareholders has gone up massively relative to the income from working. And so that's why you have this massive split now between the have-nots, the people for who years and years and years have not seen their real incomes improve at all. In fact, they're going backwards. The haves, which is quite a large proportion of people, who will include some asset holders and some stockholders, and they're getting quite good returns from dividends, if not from the ordinary wages. But then you've got the small proportion of the mega haves, as I call them, and they have done the best. So if you look at their wealth acceleration in recent times, it's directly correlated to the rise in debt and the rise in this power base that we've been talking about. So what we've got is an asymmetric story with regard to the economy. And, you know, it comes back to the old idea, I think, that the bulk of the people are under the gun, metaphorically, if not literally, because they've got no choice but to continue to play the game by the rules that are set by the players who are calling the rules. That hasn't changed for many generations. And like I said at the start of this, George, all of this idea of, you know, the globalization after the Second World War and the World Economic Forum and the UN, all those things, was part of a story set that really doesn't make a lot of sense when you understand how power works. And so as we come sort of full circle on this conversation, the thing that ordinary people need to understand is how power actually works in society, across communities and internationally, and the fact that the large international players like the US still hold all the cards and smaller players like Australia hold very few of the cards. And so when you think about policy making, for example, for Australia, it doesn't surprise me that a lot of the decisions that are actually coming out of Australia are coming through those international channels, as well as, of course, those in Australia who are trying to protect their own wealth and their own footprint. So to me, if you really want to understand what's going on, you absolutely need to understand how power works in practice.
So interesting what you just said. I want to add a little layer to what you just said. Keir Starmer made a comment or point. You will not be able to work without a digital ID. Australia is cleverly trying to push it in through this thing with Facebook, where they're asking any person under 16 would have to, or any person above 16 has to prove who they are. So it's going to affect things like the internet. I just find it interesting because if they get the digital ID happening all around the world, where does that leave us? What would the next step be? CBDC and social credit score? They consolidate their power. They not only have enormous control over where the wealth is going, but now they can control the wealth down below, which means that if Bill Gates, for example, does come up with his synthetic meat, they can set a situation where that's the only meat you'll be able to buy, for example. And so when you go to buy your groceries, more and more corporate products are appearing. And so you mentioned food, well, that can be synthetic, etc. And I think that the power is not just monopolies forming, massive monopolies, in small quantities, so the power is becoming more centralised. And where's that leave the average person? I think the term down the river without a paddle is a good one. You've probably heard that one, but that's how I feel. Call that misinformation and disinformation, if you like. We'll throw a little bit of humour into this whole thing. Over to you, Martin.
Well, it's interesting. Keir Starmer just has confirmed that, in fact, they won't make that social programme in the UK now mandatory. They've backpedaled on that. They're backpedaling a lot of programmes in recent times because of the reaction of people within the community and also within their own party. And I guess that's a little object lesson here. There is still a power that ordinary people have, which is to express their views firmly about what is and what isn't appropriate and fair and reasonable. And I don't believe that the idea of, you know, switching off X, for example, or using social scores, those sorts of things, are actually fair or reasonable, but they are actually still being propagated. Look at the Davos story, for example, still being propagated top down. But the point is, once you understand how power is actually playing and working, and understand where it could go if we're not careful, it's really important that ordinary people then actually begin to, don't just sit there passively and take it and say, well, nothing we can do about it, right? I think it's really important that people do question their politicians, question their leaders, question the strategies, and especially where programs are brought in after an election that weren't actually even mentioned during the election. Albo, I could point to a number that you've done. Because the truth is that the politicians don't have our interests at the heart of what they do. They have a whole set of other agendas, power and all those things. But unless we can actually get democracy to actually work for us again, which means, of course, that ordinary people assert what they want and believe to be right more firmly, rather than just passively letting the politicians just play it out in another sphere, then we're going to end up in a very dark place. So it comes back to a call for action, I guess, George, mm-hmm. Get yourself informed. Don't just trust the mainstream. Don't really understand what's going on. And then, very importantly, make sure that our politicians understand that we are not going to be paxes. We're not just going to say, there are things we can do. But you got to understand the way the world is and the way the power works, because that is the starting point for making any change.
Well, interesting that, because there is a bit of power amongst the common person, and that is they have this thing called currency. It still works, by the way. And where they put that currency will determine where the power goes. So if everybody suddenly walked away from the major supermarkets and suddenly went to all the small stores and they did some sort of a contract with farmers and they started to interact that way and they used cash while they still can, well, I think their power would start to diminish very quickly. And even the supermarkets would have to suddenly respond to that because they don't want to see that power diminish. So what does that mean? You mentioned food, and we might do something on food on the next program, by the way, because I think it'd be very interesting, because I've got a few ideas on that, down the rabbit hole, so to speak. I think that the general person is suffering, but most are too busy to take the time to listen to a show like Down the Rabbit Hole, for example. And they would learn a lot of things, although we don't kind of walk away with any solutions, although I've just suggested one with where you spend your money would be a big one. That would help. It would help to support all the small businesses that are dying very quickly, and I'm seeing a lot of food companies that weren't there before suddenly springing up, and they're large corporate franchises. So they're coming in, and I'm looking at them and thinking, well, that wasn't there a few years ago, and that one wasn't there a few years ago. And all these small mum and dad shops are slowly dying as these ones take over. And of course, once they take over, well, they can supply you any type of food. Who's to know what's in the food? It's like George Carlin said, and I really like George Carlin. He said, Americans, if they created a raccoon on a stick, Americans would buy that and eat it. And I thought, he's got a point there. And have you ever been to America, Martin?
Yes.
You have. Were you shocked?
Yes. Okay. Very shocked.
I was
yes,
too.
It was. Everything is of a different size, literally.
Well, we went to get a coffee at, I'm trying to remember the name of it. It was one of their big coffee chains. You know what a coffee's like in Australia? You have a little cup of coffee and that's it. Well, their smallest cup of coffee would have been considered to be an extra, extra large, and that was the small one. And when I saw the big one, and this was at Grand Central Station in New York, I thought, they're not really going to drink that, are they? That looks like it could feed a family. That's one person. And I thought, wow, that's strange. And, you know, I managed to find a little Chinese shop that I found finally some real food. I thought, I'm in New York down a little laneway and I found this little Chinese shop. I thought, oh, the food's fantastic. All the other stuff, they've changed the dietary habits of the people. And this probably explains why we've got health issues in America, in Australia, in the UK, Canada included. I don't think people actually realise what's happening. They're just, it's like a form of normalisation of the way people see things. And I think you could blame education for that. You could blame corporate monopolies working very closely with governments, might I say, very closely. You've got to ask yourself, this is getting really interesting. Just exactly where does the power really lie here?
Well, George, it's been a pleasure sharing some further thoughts with you. And, you know, as we come to the end of the show, thank you very much for the time to share your thoughts with us and also to help with the production here. We will do more rabbit hole discussions, I think, ahead, because there are so many things that we need to look at in more detail. And, you know, as we come to the end of the show, let's highlight to people that we're not trying to give specific advice. We're not trying to tell you what to do, but we are trying to highlight some questions which people need to think about. And the question to leave you with today is, if power is working the way that we've described it, what does that mean then in terms of what we need to do? George, thank you very much. We'll see you next time.
Thank you, Martin.